Welcome back to the Blue Dot Report Live Special. I'm Dave Shlom with Dr. Dave McComas. And when I look for guests to have for these one-hour specials, I always try to find somebody who's not only a leading expert in their field, but somebody that's good at talking about it. And I think Dr. McComas is very gifted at communicating, you know, rather difficult subject matter to a level we can all understand. We were just talking, Dave, about how IBEX captures these neutral atoms, these energetic neutral atoms. And you want to just kind of finish up with that. How does the camera on board actually capture these things?
Yeah, sure, Dave. It's actually very much like the process that produced them. In order to get these particles to be neutral and travel all the way in from the heliosphere's boundaries across the magnetic field lines, they had to go through a charge exchange process. When we get them inside our instrument, we actually put them through another charge exchange process, converting them back to charged particles, and that allows us to use electric fields to bend them around and measure them and calculate their speed and the direction that they were coming in from and all that sort of thing. And so we actually do the inverse process of what created them in the first place, and that's how we make our pictures. Individual neutral atoms that we convert back to charged particles, to protons, and then we measure directly.
So for our listeners, just anything that has charge, is like a magnetic field, like magnets, if you put two magnetic poles that are the same together, they'll repel each other. If you put like parts together, they'll attract each other. Things that have charge do the same thing. Like charges repel. Unlike charges attract each other. Because these are neutral, they're able to pass through all of these magnetic field boundaries in the solar system. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Yeah, I like to think of it as the charged particles are tied to the magnetic field. They basically gyrate around the magnetic field. And so they can't leave the part of the magnetic field that they're with. And so as the solar wind flows out at a million miles an hour, all these particles carry with it this magnetic field, and they're tied together. It's not until you neutralize a particle that it no longer really sees, it no longer feels the force from the magnetic field, and that's when it's able to go zipping off in whatever direction it was at the instant of charge exchange.
What are some of the big findings now that IBEX has been in orbit since, 2008?
Yes, 5 years actually tomorrow.
Okay.
Is when we launched.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thanks,
what are some of the major findings by IBEX?
Yeah, so there have been a number of really fascinating things that we had no idea about. Perhaps the first and one of the biggest is the discovery of what we call the ribbon, the IBEX ribbon. It turns out that these energetic neutral atoms are actually highly structured in the sky, and when you look out all directions and make basically a sky map of them, what you see is that there's a fairly narrow structure, about 20 degrees wide, in a big arc that goes almost all the way around the sky. And it's fascinating. You know, we were talking earlier about Voyager 1 and 2 making those local in situ measurements. It turns out that this ribbon passes right between Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, so neither of them actually see the most interesting feature in the sky that observed by IBEX, this narrow, bright ribbon. It's about three times more neutral atoms being produced in that region than outside of this ribbon.
Do I have any idea what's causing that?
We have 13 ideas right now, but we don't know which one's correct or which combination are correct. And in fact, I just finished a review article on those, sort of laying out the case, the pluses and minuses for each of those. But it's been a fascinating area because the ribbon was completely unpredicted, completely unexpected. And now, you know, there are all these very clever ideas about different ways that you might produce such a bright, narrow structure in the interaction region. I would say over the course of the next few years, I'm hopeful that we'll really be able to come to consensus on what it is. But today, it's still a big mystery.
What are some of the other big findings by IBEX?
Okay. So in addition to that, we've already been able to observe over the first 5 years some time variations in this interaction. And that's fascinating because the solar wind is produced by the sun, and the sun goes through this 11-year cycle where it flips the polarity of the magnetic field in the sun, and the solar wind structure sort of changes over that same time frame. And so we're already beginning to be able to sense how this interaction changes and breathes and evolves over the solar cycle. So it's not a static thing. And, you know, I think when we launched, we never had any idea we'd be sensitive enough to be able to tell those sorts of variations.
What have we learned about the interstellar medium from IVAX?
Yeah, so this is, these measurements I've all been talking about are from these energetic neutral atoms that are produced via charge exchange. But because we measure neutral atoms, we're also sensitive to the much lower energy neutrals that are just floating in from the interstellar medium. And they're going much slower. They're going 10, 20 times slower than the energetic neutral atoms that we observe. And so we've made the first measurements ever of interstellar, direct measurements of interstellar neon, oxygen, and hydrogen. Prior to IBEX, the only element that had been measured from the interstellar medium was interstellar helium. That was measured on the Ulysses spacecraft over a decade ago. We've made much more precise measurements of the interstellar helium, plus for the first time measured these other elements. So this is material that's come directly out of other exploded stars and fills the interstellar environment, and comes in through the boundaries, and we're able to directly observe with IBEX. Based on those observations, we've learned that the flow is actually slower than people thought before, and that means that there's not a bow shock out in front of the heliosphere. The heliosphere is moving through the interstellar medium. If it's moving fast enough, it has to form a shock in front like a supersonic jet does. But now that we've measured more accurately the speed, we can tell that basically there's only a sort of a bow wave in front of the heliosphere, not a shock. Sort of think of a boat on a pond and how it sort of pushes up a little mound of water in front of it. That's the kind of thing that's happening in front of our heliosphere. In addition to that, just published in the last few months, we've compared the recent IBEX observations on the flow direction of this material with indirect observations from a number of different sources and with this earlier Ulysses observations, and we've demonstrated that the flow direction has been rotating over the last 40 years or so. And that's really unexpected. I mean, people thought that the size and scale of the interstellar medium was so great that the chances of actually catching it in motion, catching it changing, would be infinitesimal. But they're not. And it looks like we've seen about a 6-degree rotation over the last 40 years, which may suggest that the interstellar medium is actually a lot more turbulent than people thought.
What do we know now about our local part of the galaxy that we didn't know before all of this?
We know its composition much better, and we know that the composition is not so much like the Sun, which suggests that the material in the local part of our galaxy is different from the material, the mix of materials where the Sun formed billions of years ago. So that's an important point. We know that for some reason, maybe because of turbulence, that the interstellar medium is more structured than we thought and has these rotations in velocity, which were unexpected. We know that it's moving a lot more slowly with respect to us than we thought before. So it's really quite a vastly different view of the very local interstellar medium than we had, say, a decade or even half a decade ago.
Let's go back to the idea of the heliosphere changing. If we look back in time over the Earth's history, have there likely been times when the heliosphere has been compressed and that would allow more cosmic rays in?
Yes, and in fact, I talked a little bit about the heliosphere evolving sort of the breathing with the solar cycle, but an even larger impact is by what region of interstellar medium we pass through. And over the history of the solar system, we've gone around the galaxy several times, and we sort of bob up and down across the galactic plane like a merry-go-round. Imagine a horse on a merry-go-round kind of going up and down across this galactic plane. And over that history, we've surely passed through times that were much less dense, where there was much less pressure outside, and the heliosphere would grow bigger because you're still inflating as hard from the inside with the solar wind. But even more interesting, we've probably passed through a number of times where the density and the pressure was very high outside, and it squeezed the heliosphere in, maybe all the way into where the planets were, maybe even all the way into where the Earth is. Under those conditions, you basically lose the protection we were talking about from galactic cosmic rays, and those galactic cosmic rays would have much higher much better access to the Earth and could, and probably did, cause enhanced radiation environments around the Earth.
So it's conceivable that those kinds of events could have played some kind of role in the evolution of life on Earth.
Yeah, it's conceivable that bursts of change and evolution might be tied to bursts of enhanced radiation environment, for example.
So, again, back to this idea that the heliosphere really is important to us as this protective bubble that surrounds the entire planetary system. And like you said, 10 years ago, this wasn't a topic of tremendous interest, was it?
No, it's incredibly important, and it was not really appreciated. We've gotten to a point now where people talk about, you know, what makes a habitable planet? And there are all these different things that we look for. You know, could you have liquid water? You know, and what environment and what are the temperatures and things like that? It may very well be that one of the key things to a habitable exoplanet is that it has an astrosphere around it, which is capable of protecting it.
We can observe these astrospheres, can't we?
Some of them you can. Probably not the ones around habitable planets, but for very strong interactions where there's high density and a lot of pressure, very fast speeds, you actually can get enough heating of the material that we're able to observe it, some of them with Hubble Space Telescope and some of them with ultraviolet cameras and things like that. And so if you look on the web, if you just look up astrospheres, I mean, there are a lot of really beautiful pictures of astrospheres, but they probably represent the strongest interactions out there, far stronger than the interaction we have here around our sun.
You certainly probably would not be able to observe the heliosphere from many light years away.
No, and in fact, if you could observe the heliosphere with light, we'd be doing that instead of this much more complicated, more difficult process of looking in these individual neutral atoms. But basically, there isn't the heating and the energy put into the process that, you know, that make it possible to see it through light.
How did you first get interested in studying the heliosphere?
Well, the global heliosphere came sort of naturally out of studying the solar wind, which I've done over the last 30 years in my career. And it became pretty clear that, we've learned a lot about the solar wind around the Earth, the solar wind's interaction with other planets and producing magnetic bubbles around other planets and things like that. But there were sort of two frontiers that were really left that we hadn't explored much. One was the corona directly. I mean, we've had a lot of great pictures of the corona, but we hadn't flown in and actually made measurements of the corona, and that's this solar probe mission that we're launching in 2018. It's going to fly within 10 solar radii of the sun and actually measure in situ the particles. And then the other boundary that we hadn't really explored was the outer boundary. What happens to the solar wind beyond the planets as it goes out and interacts with the local part of the galaxy? And so I became very interested in those two extremes and trying to understand the unexplored parts of the solar wind.
Now, the sun, when we have eruptions on the sun, coronal mass ejections, big bursts of particles from the sun, they really can have impacts here on Earth, can't they?
Yeah, that's another aspect of space weather. There are the galactic cosmic rays that come in from the outside and the protection of the outer heliosphere. There are also energetic particle events that come from the sun episodically from coronal mass ejections primarily, although from some other things also, which can have a large impact on space weather at Earth and, for example, affect our communication satellites, our GPS, many things in our highly technological society.
And cause beautiful auroras if you live to the north or south.
Yes, although even the really big storms, we sometimes even see them all the way down here in Texas.
We got to see some here in the North State about, I think it was in 2001,
mm-hmm.
and it was just beautiful. You know, the sky was just painted with colors. It was really amazing. We're going to be going to break again. Dave, when we come back, I'd like to talk to you more about solar science in general and your path to how you became a scientist so that you might inspire some maybe young listener to pursue a path into the sciences. This is the Blue Dot Report Special. I'm Dave Sloan with Dave McComas.